Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And today, the second and third segment today, I'm pleased to air my conversation with James Corbett that was previously recorded Wednesday evening. It's a great interview today, and I really enjoyed my time with James Corbett. So stick around. I am live right now, and we're going to go through the first 20 minutes of the program today talking about the market report. And it is Friday, November 16th, 2018. A little less, almost Thanksgiving, ladies and gentlemen. It seems to be everyone's favorite holiday anymore. It's probably the, other than Black Friday, it seems like Thanksgiving anymore. It's just not so, it's just not so commercial. You know, it's just where people get together and feast and enjoy each other's company and think about the blessings that they have in their lives. And certainly I've been blessed, and I know many of you are blessed, and I'm blessed to have you as listeners. So now that we all know that we're blessed, let's go ahead and see what let's see if gold was blessed today. And it was. Gold was up in the New York spot price aftermarket, $860 today at $1,222. We have silver up 12 cents today at $1,449. And we have platinum is up $3 at $848. And palladium, another big day for palladium, up 1.75% at $1,176, up 20. And everything has just been out of whack today. It seems must be a lot of people on the internet today. We have the U.S. dollar today. Let's see if we can get down there. See if my computer will cooperate. Doesn't seem like it is. The dollar was down 0.63 today at 96.45. Crude oil was up 0.33 at 56.79. You know, people always tell me, well, why don't you get your numbers here? Why don't you get your numbers there? And, I don't want to say I'm an old dog, but, I like my routine. I like my numbers where I usually get them, and it's hard to change. And throughout the day, I oftentimes view prices from various markets and so forth. But when I'm ready for the show, I have my favorites that I go to, and sometimes they just don't cooperate. The Dow was up 122 points today, and I guess the markets reversed themselves after President Trump came out and said, he really wants to deal with China. And of course, we all know we have the G20 meeting on the 20th, which is Tuesday, and everyone is reaching out, and hopefully they can make some sort of a big agreement and make big announcement during this meeting. I think that's what this meeting is going to be focused on, or at least that is the distraction. That is the distraction that we'll all be focusing on and that we've been given to focus on. The NASDAQ was down 11 points today at 7,247. The S&P was up 6, 2,736. 10-year yield, 3.07%. Foreign and Asian markets were quiet. Let's see what emotion is driving the market. Yesterday it was actually at 7. Today we are at 10. And, everybody uses the VIX to see, the volatility of the markets and so forth. And, this little index is a fairly easy one to understand and find and everything. And it takes in several different things. There's seven indicators that they use to show and to calculate the index. It's a seven fear and greed indicators. And if my computer cooperates, perhaps we can see. And what they include, it's produced by CNN, Money's Fear and Greed Index. They use the stock price momentum. They use the S&P versus its 125-day moving average. They use the stock price strength. This is the number of stocks hitting 52-week highs and lows on the New York Stock Exchange. They use stock price breadth, the volume of shares trading in stocks on the rise versus those declining. They use put and call options, the put call ratio, and that compares the trading volume of bullish call options relative to the trading volume of bearish put options. And the junk bond demand, this is the spread between yields on investment grade bonds and junk bonds. They also use the VIX. Of course, that measures volatility. And then they also use a safe haven demand, but for their reason of their calculations for their, you know, for what is driving the market, they use the difference in returns for stocks versus treasuries. And for each indicator, they look at how far they veered from their average relative to how far they normally veer. So when I talk about the, you know, what is the fear and greed index, and, you know, I'll talk about where the fear is now into, you know, this 10 territory, it ranges from 0 to 100. And of course, 0 is extreme fear, 50 is neutral, and of course, 100 is extreme greed. So, you know, when I talk about that, it gives me an indication of what the markets, and again, you know, we, there's a big difference between fear and panic. And this certainly doesn't manage or it doesn't produce what the panic is. So, but I find it interesting. It kind of gives you an indication, and I hope you enjoy it too. And now you have a better understanding of all those indicators that create the calculations for the fear and greed index. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk about today. My 20 minutes is always brief, and I just wanted to see something here. Okay, I got a breaking news report, but they were just talking about the weekly losses on the stocks. There was a banker who worked closely with President Trump on debt restructuring, and he sees a big problem coming for the market. Billionaire Ken Moelis, who runs his own investment bank, and he once represented President Trump. He also has negotiated deals for Dubai, the Saudis, and Steve Wynn. And he expects a wave of problems for leveraged companies as interest rates rise. So these, you know, when we talk about the, you know, the leveraged companies and the interest rates rising, it reminds me prior to the subprime mortgage situation, because we were all talking about the adjustable rates and how so many people were, you know, underwater, and, you know, the people were beginning to have these layoffs and they couldn't afford the revised payment schedule. They couldn't afford it because they went out and they bought these McMansions, and you know, their debt kept increasing. And this kind of reminds me of the same lead up into another financial crisis, only this is going to be the granddaddy of all financial crises when this one's hit. And of course, you know, the corporations, multinational corporations, the leveraged companies, yeah, they're going to get creamed. They can't service their debts. They've gone into debt in order to buy back their shares. There's been record stock buybacks. And people say, well, you know what? You know, no, ladies and gentlemen, this is a big deal. And they have to service their debt. It's no different than government with rising rates. Cost the government more money to service the debt. So all their other little programs and all their other little spending areas that the money goes into can't go there because it's going to the servicing the debt. Eventually, that debt can no longer be serviced, and you all know what happens after that. But Ken Moelis, he's the founder and CEO of an investment bank. He's represented a lot of high-profile clients over decades as a corporate deal maker. And he said, there's a big problem. He's beginning to see things breaking down. And he's worried about the capital. He says access to capital was the whole thing in the 80s, and the world has changed. And he says capital is no longer a barrier. Capital is being thrown at you by multiple sources, and that will be the problem. He says due to the direction in interest rates, he provided a note of caution about debt at this conference that he attended. And he said he is very concerned, and most likely he sees a big, big problem that's coming to the market very soon. We saw Nordstrom, they took a plunge after taking a $72 million charge for customer credit card refunds. Well, if people are, getting big discounts from the tax cuts and everything else, you wouldn't think that they would be defaulting on their credit cards to Nordstrom's. Their earnings, Nordstrom's earnings fell short of expectations. Nordstrom's wrote down $72 million in credit card refunds to customers who were incorrectly charged higher interest rates. Well, this is a little bit of a different problem. The one-time charge drove its net income down 42% to $67 million or 39 cents a share during the 3 months ending November 3rd. So they have taken steps. And again, it's like, well, you just don't overcharge people. It's kind of like Wells Fargo. They do all these things to their customers, basically create false accounts, charge people huge sums of fees and so forth. And how many gets to go to jail? Who really is held accountable for anything? No one. Doesn't seem no one ever gets held accountable for any of the things that they do. So this is just another sign, just another problem that just is ignored, but eventually it does catch up. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about delinquencies, the student delinquencies up again as U.S. household debt hits another record. The total debt shouldered by Americans has hit another record high, rising to 13.5 trillion dollars in the last quarter. While an unusual jump in student loan delinquencies could provide another signal that the U.S. economic expansion is growing old, flows of student debt into serious delinquency or of 90 or more days rose to 9.1% in the third quarter from 8.6% in the previous quarter. Then this was reported by today by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that propelled the biggest jump in the overall U.S. delinquency rate in 7 years. And I asked myself, you have all of these socialists and discussions of socialists and free this and free that. I wonder how many of these, is it really due to a bad economy, or is it a combination due to the economy not being as what we're told? Or is it just these students who think, yeah, I don't have to pay for my student debt because, eventually this is, we're going to get enough politicians, socialist politicians in there who they talk about it every day that, college should be free. We shouldn't have to pay for it. So I wonder how many of these of the student delinquencies are just actively being created, or is it due to a true hardship in the economy, or is it a combination of both? This was a reversal after a period of improvement for student debt, which totaled $1.4 trillion. So we've also seen serious delinquency flows growing on auto debt since 2012. Credit card debt last year also has been rising in the delinquency area. So, I mean, these are all red flags. These are all two by fours that are floating out there to tell you what's going on. I mean, these one and one is not equaling two in this economy that we have. We've certainly, as the world's largest economy, we certainly have grown well above the potential this year. On this back of the strong consumer spending, of course. And of course, this is the lowest unemployment rate since the 60s. So if growth continues for another year, it will be the longest U.S. expansion ever. But again, we talk about time and time and time again, all these indicators, all these warnings, all these other little signs that certainly show that perhaps this growth is not going to continue for another year. Total household debt driven by a $9.1 trillion in mortgages is now $837 billion higher than its previous peak in 2008. Total household debt driven by $9.1 trillion in mortgages, is now $837 million higher than its previous peak in 2008. So we just as the last recession took hold and brought on massive deleveraging across the United States, indebtedness has risen steadily for more than 4 years and sits more than 21% above the current trough in 2013. The $209 billion rise in total debt in the quarter ended September 30th was the biggest jump since 2016. And we certainly have had a lot of beeps. We've certainly, you know, I'm a great boss. I send everybody home on Friday. So when I do, you know, no one's working. Carla's not working. Jasmine's not working. Dave's not working. The boss is working. So this is what we do for Fridays when we have Corbett. Everybody goes home, and I do this first 20 minutes live for the program. And so my apologies for all the beeps and talking that came in as I'm talking about the debt, student debt. Mortgage delinquency transactions worsened slightly. Transitions worsened slightly with the central bank having settled into a gradual rate hike cycle. Mortgage originations grew to $445 billion, suggesting that borrowers are locking in lower costs while they can. And we just have a few more minutes left of this segment before we go into the James Corbett program. And just a couple of the headlines today. We saw U.S. manufacturing production. That did increase a little bit. I talked about the U.S. household debt continues to climb. We do have the blog that is going out today talks a little in depth about the Brexit. So if you'd like to get a copy of our blog today, make sure you go to the website, dgscoins.com, sign up where it has the newsletter, because if you sign up for the newsletter, you will also get the blog that we produce on Fridays and Saturdays, depending on when we can get it done after a busy week. So it is about Brexit, and it's important to know, because eventually it's going to circle around the globe, whatever negative Brexit might have in the economy. Let's see, weak credit growth raises odds of first China rate cut in years, and we're out of time. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call. The boss is here till 6 o'clock, ladies and gentlemen, so keep me busy. So I can tell them, you guys can't have off anymore. Hey, I'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with James Corbett. Hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. This is one of my favorite segments of Financial Survival, when I get to spend the next 40 minutes with James Corbett. And I think you all know that James is the founder and the editor of the Corbett Report, which he started in 2007. And in 2012, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster, which was created by Robert Chapman, my good friend. And you can visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com. And also, you can go to the International Forecaster and request a complimentary copy of the newsletter. So please go there, visit both websites. James has some fabulous interviews and also some great editorials, documentaries, I encourage you to go there. You will learn a lot. And welcome. It's great to have you here again, James.
Well, that was quite the introduction. I hope I can live up to it, but thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk with you, as always.
You are going to today, I promise.
I better.
Well, you know, last week we had the elections, the midterm elections, and a couple of weeks ago you told the listeners your thoughts on the upcoming midterms, and the results are still sort of a work in progress. Do you have any post-election perspectives?
Yes, I do. I just released a video called "If Voting Changed Anything... dot dot dot," and we all know how that how that sentence ends. If voting changed anything... dot dot dot. They'd make it... You know? They'd make it illegal. They'd make it illegal. If voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. So, that was... That's a phrase we've all heard. But probably few people know where it actually comes from. There are people who believe that it comes from Mark Twain or Emma Goldman, but there's no proof of that. It actually... The earliest published instance of that phrase is from the Lowell Sun, from Lowell, Massachusetts, in a 1976 a letter to the editors that was published there. Under the headline, voting is fraudulent, is dishonest and fraudulent. And so basically the gist of that, as you can imagine, is essentially, well, voting is an immoral activity because it's basically a portion of the population, not even 51% or whatever, but actually 51% of that portion of the population that votes. So it ends up being something like 42% or so of the population telling the rest of the population how to live through their represented democracy candidate, right? Which is a farce. So this is the way that I view the elections. And I view this specifically because I am looking quite closely right now at a specific slice of history, specifically that piece of history leading up to the advent of World War I. I've just released the first part of my World War I documentary that will be coming out over the next few weeks. So I've been looking at this quite closely lately. And something that's really stuck out for me is further proof that ultimately, you vote how you want and vote for the policies you think you want, but if it doesn't comport with the real financiers and string pullers ideas for society, you're probably not going to get what you want. A very specific example of that comes from England. Hold on. England in 1905, where there was a government. It was led by Prime Minister Arthur Balfour. He resigned as Prime Minister, and so there was an election. And this election, one of the issues that it turned on was the idea of peace. There was this other candidate from the other party. His name was Henry Campbell Bannerman, and he ran on this campaign of peace. We have to, we in Britain have to take on, become the leaders of the League of Peace. We have to show that armaments is not the way to go, that, look, Europe is arming and clearly getting ready for war and altercation, but we have to counteract that. Peace, peace, peace. And his party won a landslide victory, a landslide in that election, because people, generally speaking, when offered the choice, generally want peace. They don't want war. And so it was extremely popular. So what did the people who were in the positions of power in the conservative government that were suddenly out of office, what did they do in all of this? They literally conspired to get themselves key positions in the new incoming Liberal Party government. So that's exactly what they did. This is mainline history. This is not, you know, shadowy conspiracy theory. This is, go look it up on Wikipedia. It's called the Regulus Compact. And it was about these three important politicians who banded together to basically conspire to get themselves in, appointed to important positions in this new incoming government so that they could essentially continue exactly what was happening under the old government, which was preparations for war, which, of course, eventually, you know, within 8 or 9 years, became the First World War. It really stemmed from that. So the people go to the ballot box thinking peace, peace, and out comes war, no matter who they vote for. Exactly the same as fast forward a decade, 1916, the re-election of Woodrow Wilson in the 1916 election. He was running on a campaign. One of his campaign slogans was literally, "He kept us out of war." You know, hey, vote for Wilson. He's the peace candidate. He's not going to get us involved in that war in Europe. We don't want any part of that. Within a year of getting elected, the United States is in World War One. So, again, it happens time and time again. And this is, I think, the longer-term historical perspective that we have to have on these elections. It's great. It feels great to go out and vote for a candidate and get on a political team. It feels great to engage in that. And if your team wins, yay, you get that buzz. But at the end of the day, what fundamental policy issues are being changed here? And I don't know, maybe it's a function of getting older or whatever, but I'm more and more interested on the longer term trends and less on the news of the day. And when you look at the longer term trends, I'm not sure anything at all is accomplished by these voting rituals.
I agree with you, and it seems like, and I've heard, you know, for years and years, you hear people say, what difference does it matter? I mean, there's the agenda. The agenda is going, it's going to be all the same. There's no difference from one party to the other. And you talk about wars. I was just reading prior to the program, America has spent $6 trillion on wars in the Middle East and Asia just since 2001, in 20 years, $6 trillion. You know, 480,000 people have died from the wars, and more than 244,000 civilians have been killed, and another 10 million have been displaced due to the violence. So is war the only thing they know how to do? I mean, is it just human nature to go to war, or is it just...
You know, that's a great question, because that goes to the heart of the issue. In fact, I would argue it is the exact opposite. War goes against human nature. And we know this from a lot of different perspectives. One that's key and fascinating and interesting is that when they started doing studies in World War One and World War II, of how many soldiers would actually fire their weapons in combat, and when fired, what was their actual kill rate? I mean, were they actually aiming to kill, or were they just aiming to look like they were firing something? And they found, I don't have the percentages off the top of my head, but it was a very small percentage of soldiers were actually firing in battle, and even smaller amount were actually hitting anything. Not because they were necessarily poor shots, but because humans, generally speaking, unless you're in a struggle with someone face-to-face that is an attacking you or something like that, generally speaking, people don't want to go and blow someone's head off. It is not a natural state. And so, of course, what did military planners do as a result of this data that they were getting? Well, they figured out, well, we have to start engineering soldiers who will want to kill. So, of course, they had to get over the trigger fear, and they had to do all sorts of things, including training with conditioning with the, you know, the pop-up targets that you have to fire within a couple of seconds. And through these types of training exercises and things that they then incorporated, they have gotten that percentage of soldiers that will fire in combat up to whatever it is. Again, I don't have the percentages, but 80-90% or whatever it is. So mission accomplished, they've managed to train people, but they have to be trained into actually firing their weapons in combat. Doesn't that seem counterintuitive? I mean, people are warlike and warriors and they just want to kill, and actually no. Actually, they have to be engineered and trained into the idea of trying to kill other people in combat like that. That's an interesting window into the sort of bigger question here, because why does the average working class guy in Manchester want to go across to the continental Europe to go shoot at Germans? I mean, does he really care that much? Well, actually, probably not, unless he's whipped into a fervor by propaganda and conditioning and all of these things. So that, I think, is really the issue here. Generally speaking, people don't want war. And again, they voted overwhelmingly in that 1906 election for peace. And they voted overwhelmingly in America for the re-election of Woodrow Wilson. He kept us out of war. But again, it doesn't really matter with the agenda. So the real question is, well, then why? Why do the steerers, the ship steerers, the real people, the string pullers, why do they want war so much? And I think the answer is, I mean, there's many different answers, including, of course, you can never go wrong by saying money. Money's always an issue, and certainly in the World War One case, that was absolutely the case. There was incredible amounts of money being thrown around, sloshed around through the governments that were spending incredible sums on their armaments industries, including in the United States. And I can't remember the name of the board that was created by the Wilson administration to oversee the wartime spending. I think it was the War Armaments Board or something like that. But run, of course, by a Wall Street financier with deep connections to the usual J.P. Morgans and Wall Street gang and what have you, who also happened to be one of the people who helped Woodrow Wilson into office in the first place, named Bernard Baruch. And he oversaw however many, you know, tens of millions of dollars back in the day when tens of millions of dollars was a lot of money. He helped to oversee that expense for the country, and obviously pocketed some of it himself, but also for his cronies on Wall Street. And that's an incredibly important part of the story. There are other reasons too, though. I mean, even the idea that war can condition a people into accepting different ways of living and understanding their world, which World War I certainly did. It was truly a watershed moment in history, and one of those watersheds was just the idea of government intervention in the economy, especially in the American context, where, you know, it's the United States, freedom, liberty, and the government should be small and there to protect people's liberty and little else. But somehow or other, during the course of World War One, all of these ideas that seemed unthinkable started to become the norm. Well, of course, the government has to oversee production of various things for the war effort, and so they have to get involved. They have to appoint this war armaments board. They have to start spending money on this. Now we have this income tax. Well, we have to start taxing the population to pay for this, and oh, well, we need these Liberty Bonds, and of course that will all be financed through the Wall Street banks that'll be able to pocket a lot of that money as well. And so it all revolves around the increase of the power and the size of the state. And this is, of course, one of the key theses of historian Robert Higgs in his book on Leviathan and the State. Oh, I'm not going to get that name off the top of my head. But anyway, his key treatise on this is about how with every war, the state grows and grows and grows, and then afterwards it might control a little bit, but certainly not back to where it was before. And then the next war comes along and the state grows and grows and grows. So we end up with the state of the United States 2018, which is such an incredibly monstrously large bureaucracy with all of this trillions of dollars of funding. This would have been unthinkable and unfathomable to people from the World War One era, not just because of the dollar figures involved because of inflation, but just the idea that the government is so much involved in everyone's life. It's taken for granted now, but only because of things like war, which condition the people into expecting that the state is going to be the determining agent in their lives.
Well, you know, you go back prior to, you know, World War One, maybe even part of World War One, maybe even part of World War Two, but there was maybe a guise of, you know, it's your patriotic duty, you're fighting for freedom. They still use that, you know, you're fighting for your freedom, the people's freedoms here in the States and so forth. But I think actually now today people are signing up, they're joining for jobs, you know, for college.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to get health care.
Yeah. Exactly.
You have these young men who are, you know, and women who are joining the service for really what reason? And they're just there for the taking of those who control, and have the agenda to fight for,
yes,
you know,
right,
those reasons.
It's portrayed as the volunteer army as opposed to the conscript army, right? But it isn't really volunteer in that sense, because of course it has to be, the pot has to be sweetened with various incentives, which come in the form of experience that will be applicable in job markets in the future and or college and things like that. Of course it comes with those. And so of course it preys on people who are most financially vulnerable. Mm-hmm. The people who need that help the most tend to be. And so that actually works out very well for the ruling classes, who never have to put their sons and daughters in harm's way if they don't want to, but the poorest people in the nation don't really get that much choice. So they tend to be the ones that actually fight these wars that the chicken hawks up in the administration are only too happy to wage with other people's blood.
And so often the lower classes that go in there really don't have any idea what they're fighting for.
And that is, I mean, it's been said many times, but it's true. I mean, this is how most people learn geography these days. It's, are we fighting a war where? Yemen? What is that? Where is that? And they might learn something about the geography of the Middle East from the wars that are waged there, but that's about it. And most people wouldn't be able to point it out on a map. Most people wouldn't be able to tell you anything about the country, but we got to be over there for some reason.
Yeah, no one really knows, and yet lives are lost, and it's costing us billions and billions and trillions of dollars. So I don't know. You know, it's, you know, you go through these elections, and you just, you know, and people have so much hope. It's just surprising. There was a lot of hope for this administration. Even, you know, I mean, I'm certainly not a fan of Obama's, but with that class of that group of people, they had so much hope. Mm-hmm. In that administration.
And the frustrating thing from my perspective anyway is that I appreciate that and I understand. I completely sympathize with people who have hope and want this to be different. Of course, we all want it to be different. But it's strange to me that the people who vote in someone like Obama because of hope and change, when they don't get the hope and change, after 4 years, after 8 years, eventually they say, well, he was just one man and he couldn't do everything. So kind of admitting that actually the vote wasn't that meaningful in the first place. And exactly the same now. Let's live through that with the MAGA era. And, you know, 4 years from now or 8 years from now, it'll be Trump. Well, he was just one man. He couldn't do everything again. Yeah. I mean, we know this script. It's the same script every 4 to 8 years. But here it comes.
Yeah. And it's... So it is real interesting. We're just about ready to go into a break. I did want to talk to you. You touched on it briefly on your documentary on World War I. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that if you would like to, or if you want to, you know, go on to something.
It's basically all I've been thinking about lately, so it's probably all I can talk about in any detail. Okay. So let's do that.
Okay, we'll do that when we come back from the break. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melanie Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett of The Corbett Report. Please visit the website, thecorbettreport.com, and make sure you get to the International Forecaster and request a complimentary issue of that great, great newsletter. Comes out twice weekly, I believe, doesn't it, James? I believe, yes.
Yes. It comes out in midweek, Wednesdays, and weekend Saturdays.
Yes. Your documentary, World War One, and I'm real anxious to hear what you found and to tell the listeners. And, you know, it was always the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand that was the... I don't know what you want to call it. The reason there was a World War One, and I think you found something different.
Right. Yes. Indeed. That's a good way of putting it, because that is the one-line summary that everyone will ever hear about World War One in whatever news soundbite they might hear about World War One. And I actually had that experience the other day after having spent, well, years now, actually, researching World War One, but the last few months in particular, really immersed in this and the real details of how World War One came about. And I was driving around here the other day and listening to the NHK local Japanese news, and they mentioned the centenary celebration, I don't know, commemoration, whatever you want to say, that was going on in Europe for the 100th anniversary of the armistice. And they gave that literal one-line summary, World War One, which started when the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated. Which this is what people learn. This is what they tend to know. And maybe if you had a good teacher in high school or wherever you may have learned about World War One, maybe they explained a little bit about the context of Europe at that time and a little bit about British Empire and Germany, and but probably not too much. And generally speaking, I imagine World War One is pretty much taught just as a prelude to World War Two these days. So most people probably don't know much more of the story than that. There is much more to the story, of course. I think the interesting part of that story, though, is that even by the official story, even by that one-sentence summary, World War One started as the result of a conspiracy, the conspiracy to assassinate Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, which involved at least the six assassins, plus their handler, but involved other peoples and groups and the Black Hand and all of that, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, I found that when doing this research and digging into the books that question the official narratives, there was a much bigger conspiracy involved in trying to start World War One, one that you could trace back at least a couple of decades to the 1890s, where there was the formation of a secret society. And cue the spooky music and oh, the conspiracy theory, but there was a secret society that was founded by Cecil Rhodes, who... probably most people have heard of Rhodes of Rhodesia, which of course became Zimbabwe, who was an incredibly wealthy, incredibly influential and powerful man in his time. And his money came from the diamond mines and the gold mines in South Africa, in the region of what is today South Africa, which at the time there was the Cape Colony, which was part of the British Empire, but there was the Transvaal and other things. So this was an area where he came to power and prominence, and he made incredible amounts of money there. And when thinking about what to do with that money, he didn't have a family. He wasn't a family man. He didn't have a wife, didn't have children. What was he going to do with his wealth? And he, for a strange reason, I don't know if he was suffering from certain health issues that he knew, but at any rate, from a very young age, he was already writing wills and thinking about how he would leave his fortune. And it turns out he was right. He died relatively young, I believe 41 or 42, something like that, back in 1902. And when he died, it was discovered that he had, well, it was published, actually, by one of his co-conspirators. He didn't just have one will, which is the one that everyone learns about, the seventh will, which was started the Rhodes Scholarship. He had seven different wills, and these wills sketched out this idea for this secret society and how it was going to be funded and what it was going to do. And one of the reason that we know about this, essentially, is because one of his close conspirators blew the whistle, essentially. He published the wills. He talked about this openly. I point in the documentary to a 1902 New York Times article that was published in the New York Times shortly after Rhodes' death, talking about Rhodes' secret society and his grand vision for the British Empire, basically, the British race going out and taking its rightful place as the conquering nation of the world and spreading enlightenment and democracy and whatever to the rest of the world at the barrel of a gun. But that part was implied, because of course it was about peace. It was establishing the peace of the world under essentially the British flag, and his idea was uniting America with Britain and, you know, uniting the English speaking peoples and all of this. And that was his idea, and it sounds crazy, and it kind of was crazy. If you go and read some of Cecil Rhodes' musings, he would look up at the stars and wish that he could colonize the moon for the British race and things like this. I mean, just crazy ramblings. But this was an incredibly wealthy and powerful man who had incredibly wealthy and powerful friends. And some of the friends that he brought into this secret society that he started took a look at some of this, you know, spooky Illuminati-type stuff that he wanted to do and said, well, that's all nice. Now let's actually make this into something real. And they started to work on political manipulations. And one of his key co-conspirators was named Alfred Milner, Sir Alfred Milner, later Lord Alfred Milner, who most people probably have never heard of, but was one of the most important people in British politics at the turn of the century. Probably, if you wanted to pin World War I on a person, it probably wouldn't go too far wrong by saying Lord Milner started World War I. He was the string puller here, who did all sorts of political maneuvers and was the center, the focus of this group. What grew out of Rhodes' secret society into something that has been called the Milner Group, or it was later called the Round Table. It has these different names. It was an amorphous group. It's not like you had to take a blood oath or something to sign up to this group. It's just that there were certain people who worked together behind the scenes of power that included Alfred Milner and other people in British society at that time. And they worked together for a period of essentially 15 years or so before World War I to construct what became the network, the mesh of alliances and military compacts and agreements and under-the-table understandings that led to the outbreak of war. Because we're always fed that line. Well, okay, the Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo, and that got the Austrians mad, obviously, so they wanted to go conduct an investigation in Serbia using Austrian forces, but then Serbia said no, and so they called on Russia, and then Austria called on Germany, and bada bing, bada boom, World War I. Where did those alliances come from? Why was Russia aligned with France and with England in this triple entente? What was that all about, and how did that come about? And that's the real crux of this story, because those alliances didn't just come out of nowhere, and they didn't just happen for no reason. They were deliberately put into a place over a period of years and deliberately kept from the, not only from the public, but even from the British government itself. Some of the key members in the cabinet of what would become Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith at that time in the build-up to war was deliberately lying to Parliament about these secret agreements that they had with France and with Russia about military alliances and the negotiations they were actively engaged in at that time. And later on, they went and their memoirs memoirs and said, oh, we just kind of forgot to tell cabinet about these agreements. And, you know, at a certain point it became, well, we hadn't told them about it for so long, we can't really tell them now. These ridiculous excuses for why even the British government didn't really understand just how deeply in up to their necks in this they were until it was really too late. And all it took was some destabilizing event somewhere in Europe to set off this chain of events that would lead to war exactly as it was planned to take place. That's an incredibly important part of this story, but not one you're going to read in most of the mainline history books. You can get all of these pieces from all of the official sources, the transcripts of parliamentary meetings, the memoirs of these various people, the books were written at the time about these people, books written by co-conspirators like William T. Stead, but no one connects those dots in a narrative that makes sense, except for people like Jerry Dougherty and Jim McGregor, who wrote this incredibly important book, Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War, that does connect a lot of those pieces. So one of the people I talked to in this documentary is Jerry Dougherty about how this all came about. And I think the important part of this is, well, why? You know, what do we care? It was World War One. It was 100 years ago. I think the point is because if we don't know history, we're doomed to repeat it. And many people are saying there are a lot of parallels going on right now with World War One. And could it be that we are being maneuvered into another war scenario? I think that the parallels are there, and we need to know about that history and what really happened so that we can avoid doing that again.
Why has this been so ignored? I mean, yes, it's 100 years, but why hasn't anyone tried to connect the dots or bring in, is it just they don't allow it, or they just...
It's a combination of things, and this goes to the heart of the question of history and what it is and how it's constructed and how do we learn about it. This gets very philosophical very quickly.
Yeah, it does.
But we can look at specific things like the creation of the American Historical Association Society. I don't know the exact moniker, but that was created shortly after World War One and funded into existence by the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and others, who, according to Norm Dodd, who was the chief investigator for a congressional commission in the 1950s that was looking into the foundations and what they were really up to, the tax-exempt foundations, he said that from the access that he had to the Carnegie endowment records and things like that, that they were specifically setting up historical associations so that they could control what was being taught in American history classes and, you know, world history classes in America. And he talked about how they would how they set up the grants to make sure that they could collect maybe the couple dozen of the top upcoming young historical scholars in America, and they would send them over to England for, you know, on a scholarship to get trained and to make sure that they would toe the appropriate line and write about the appropriate things, and then they would fund their books and their studies on certain topics so to ensure that the historical record got shaped in a certain way. Again, it sounds like outlandish conspiracy theory, but then you get down to the present day, and everything that we know about something like World War One is being constructed, A, by people who have been steeped their whole lives in these narratives that were formed after the war, after the fact, by these scholars that had been handpicked and formed that sort of historical consensus, if you will. It's settled science. Where have we heard that before?
Oh.
But also from historical records that themselves have been meticulously picked over, so that you'll find in a lot of different cases, in a lot of different ways, key parts of the historical record, there's missing records here and there. You know, the month of diplomatic cables between Austria between Serbia and Russia, the month leading up to the assassination of the Archduke, for example, just happens to be missing. And where do those diplomatic cables go and why? Well, we'll just fill in that gap in the historical record with what we think must have happened. And you'll find that in all sorts of key phases of World War One history, specifically. Again, that's what I'm looking into right now. There's all these different parts of the historical record that have been scrubbed clean, and people's personal letters that have been destroyed and things like this. So we will never, at this point, probably never be able to 100% construct this is what happened in this order by this person and on some of the key events leading up to World War One. But we do know that we can see then how the narrative was shaped after the fact because, oh, well, we don't know what the British cabinet was discussing in June 1914. So we'll just imagine what they were discussing. And we can see the narratives that's been inserted there. So I think there's this issue of what is history and how do we come to it? How do we learn it? Who taught us it and who taught them it? And where does these kind of received wisdoms and these ideas come from? There is still research and academic historical research that goes on in World War One to this day. And just a few years ago, there was a big book out about the sleepwalkers, which again pushes this narrative. Yeah, okay, it wasn't all Germany's fault, which is what, of course, they decided in the peace treaty, quote unquote, of Versailles, which of course just led to World War Two. Where it was all Germany's fault 100% and they had to pay for everything. Well, historical scholars these days, I mean, well, you know, of course it wasn't all Germany's fault, but they try to paint this picture. Oh, they just slept, walked into it. No one really understood what was happening and they all thought, oh, we could get over this, and then they just kind of stumbled into war. Well, I don't tend to think that that's the coincidence theory, the incompetence theory, I don't think is more persuasive than the fact that there were people who openly admitted that they were trying to steer England into war with Germany, and they were successful in doing so. And I think that's the part of the story that we can't lose for all the fireworks and flair of the historical scholars who want us to direct our attentions towards different narratives.
Well, I just want to encourage your listeners to get to your website and view the documentary. And my last question of the evening is, you talked about Rhodes, you talked about the Carnegies. Who are the families of today that are replacing those families, or are those families and their wealth still play a major part?
It's a good question because, I mean, again, this is the question that everyone always asks, who is at the top? And I don't know. If I knew that answer, I guess I'd either be dead or corrupted or bought off or something.
You have to join that secret society.
Yeah. My answer to that tends to be, well, I don't know who is the one in control and which family controls what. But I do know that at the end of the day, we give them whatever power we have by participating in their rigged elections, and by giving our money and our time and our attention to the prescribed things that Wall Street wants us to think about and invest in, and Madison Avenue tells you must have the latest shiny Apple iPhone or whatever it is. These are the types of things that they try to direct our attention towards. So the answer has to be us withdrawing our participation and our investment in their system and creating systems of our own, which, given the technology we have now, is more available than ever before. I mean, I'm here in Japan talking to you in America. Yeah. We're doing this. I mean, it's unthinkable that we could be doing this, but here we are. So that's always my message on that. I mean, we could talk about, you know, the J.P. Morgan company and what became of that but at the end of the day, I think what's important is what we can do about this.
Well, I appreciate it, James. As always, I enjoyed this time spending with you, and I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. So be safe, ladies and gentlemen. You be safe also. We'll talk to you real soon. Thank you for joining us.
There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Oh.